Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Foreign Correspondents Club. I'm Keith Bradshaw of the New York Times, and I'll be your host today on behalf of the board of the FCC. Before I introduce our speaker today, please let me remind everybody, please turn off your cell phones now. Everybody, if you all check now, we are recording it. We have a television camera there. We don't want Dr. Juan to say something particularly interesting and you can't quite hear it over somebody's ring. So please all turn off your, check your phones now. Second of all, we have another speaker tomorrow. Mark Kitto is somebody who is known for having set up a series of magazines in major Chinese cities, describing some of the attractions in those English language magazines. He then moved into a mountain village in Zhejiang province, where he set up a coffee shop and really tried to get inside of what were the local relationships and so forth there. He'll be our speaker tomorrow, then we have a quiet period leading up to Chinese New Year. With that, let me introduce our speaker today. Dr. Juan is one of China's best-known foreign policy intellectuals. He is one of the four vice presidents of the China Institute of International Studies, which is the think tank arm of the foreign ministry. He has rotated between writing books there and also doing tours as one of the most senior people in the Chinese embassy in London and the Chinese embassy in Washington. He's particularly known as a scholar on China-US relations. He's the author of a popular new book that came out last month in China on how Washington works. With that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Juan.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. And I hope you can see me. Well, I would like, first of all, to thank President Douglas Wong and Vice President Tara Joseph and Francis Malatin and Mr. Governor Ken Bradshaw for your kind inviting me here at the FCC. As I understood, the FCC was established 40 years ago in Chongqing, which I happened to be there over more than 20 years ago. I was a student at Chongqing. So here, you look at the collection here. And I'm so delighted to be here because I understand the FCC is an important media hub. And it can serve as a very useful instrument to spread understanding between China and the world. I appreciate your kindness and your hospitality at such a wonderful setting, and of course with such a distinguished audience. Well, my experience working in London and Washington told me there is no free lunch. So after such a wonderful meal, probably it's time for me to share some of my thoughts with you about the year 2013 and China's foreign policy. Well, as a matter of fact, last month today, many people, maybe many of us, have experienced or even bothered by the stressful Maya prophecy. Thankfully, we're all doing very well, and I'm sure we're going to do even better. Anyway, the 2012, however, marked by leadership transition in numerous countries in the world, including Russia, France, America, Japan, South Korea, etc. It was a pretty eventful year. And in China, the 18th CPC National Congress was held in Beijing, and also in the coming months, particularly March, we will have another two very important events. That is the NPC, National People's Congress, and also CPPCC, the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference. That will pave the way for a new team who are guiding China in the next few years. And certainly that will offer a new vision for China's renaissance. This year begins with a long list of China's diplomatic challenges, such as stand for Diaoyu Islands with Japan, and evacuation of Chinese nationals in Central Africa. And also three Chinese workers were kidnapped by militants in Sudan Darfur region, just to name a few. This year, of course, we have good cause to wonder about the future. On one hand, America and Europe face concerns about the slow economic progress. Nations in Asia, Africa, Latin America have made a robust advancement in their economic development. However, the old enmities and the zero-sum mentality die hard. The increasing pressure on resources causes worry about the scarcity and puts a strain on the world environment. Be very honest, when talking to my friends, I was struck by two totally different perceptions about China's foreign policy. On one hand, the critics fear that China is going to become more and more assertive. Of course, while the others blame China for being too soft in dealing with, for example, the territorial disputes with other countries. I trust both views are particularly fueled by the recent territorial disputes and maritime fractions concerning China's sovereignty. Just let me walk you through some of the basic facts and observations. Diffusion of power and the critical trend and why that matters. This world remains far from tranquil. Local conflicts and the hotspots issues kept emerging, and the traditional and non-traditional security threats are intertwined. About 100 years ago, that is to say 1913, if the history may serve as a reminder, the world witnessed a profound change, such as the rise of the West and the fall of the East, and the emergence of America and Germany. And such a shift, redistributed enormously the wealth and the power in different regions and different countries. However, this rise and fall of great powers turned their relationship into an increasingly tense and conflict-ridden. The situation today changed quite remarkably since the turn of the century. The economic balance of power have indeed shifted dramatically in the past few years with the rapid rise of China and other emerging countries. You can say it's deja vu all over again. The world is at cross today. Let's remember how we got here. Particularly the rise of BRICS countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and other emerging economies has promoted the spread and the development of global wealth and power in a more balanced manner. BRICS is becoming the new center of influence. The combined GDP of G7 industrialized economies, the United States, United Kingdom, Japan, Germany, France, Canada, and Italy, have decreased from more than 70% of the world total GDP 2 decades ago to 50% now, as the combined of GDP of BRICS countries have increased rapidly from 15% of the world's total a decade ago to 25% now, and is still growing pretty fast. Asia Century is on the horizon as a result. Chinese economy used to be number two in 1913, 100 years ago, now ranks second once again in the history. What a coincidence. The global financial crisis caused by the Wall Street's hubris has accelerated Beijing's relative rise. However, the current conditionality is strikingly different from what was looked like 100 years ago. The ongoing change in China is surely monumental and profound. As a home of 1.3 billion people, China now is embarking a huge drive for industrialization and modernization. Both the scale and intensity are second to none in the human history. By comparison, let me give you a comparison. Great Britain, when it kicked off the industrialization drive, only a few million people. America in the 19th centuries, it's at most it has 100 million people, but for today's China, it's 1.3 billion people, just to imagine. So accordingly, both the challenges and opportunities for China and the world are unprecedented. The post-crisis era, this is very often people talk about, is by no means a predictable one. As a matter of fact, the economic and trade status are pretty unsettling with the rising of protectionism. The Europeans are struggling with their debt crisis, and the debt ceiling is fast approaching when America just averted its fiscal cliff. The Middle East is redefining itself after the so-called Arab Spring. As fighting engulfs Syria, it is becoming Lebanon-like. Very unfortunate. And the Iranian nuclear crisis remains pending. Back here at Asia, it is getting more complex and volatile. America's pivot to Asia and or the rebalance is sending a wrong message to its allies and partners with risk of extending overcommitment. So they will become bellicose and provocative and will be constantly challenging the status quo in East Asia. Japan is turning right fast. What it has done on the Diaoyu Island issue is more than a territorial dispute with China, but attempted to delay the world war outcome. Today, it will jeopardize China's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Tomorrow, it will do the same to yours if unchecked. What is the newest vision for China now? New challenges requires new response. In this very dynamic world, Beijing is required to identify its nuanced vision for the future. It is imperative for Chinese policymakers to recalibrate its analysis and policy options. Let me just characterize some of them. First, they just concluded the 18th Party's National Congress. They call for, quote unquote, promoting equality, mutual trust, inclusiveness, mutual learning, and the mutual beneficial cooperation in international relations. It is critically important that China should insist on and safeguard the basic principles. Those are embedded in the United Nations Charter and international norms. China, as a member of the P5, permanent member in the Security Council, shoulder a responsibility to stand for responsible protection when addressing the hotspots like a Syria crisis. And it's not surprising, though, China's initiated a notion that We should strive to build a new type of major power relations, which features sustainable, healthy development and non-confrontational coexistence. Although some people, both at home and abroad, question that, let's say, that suggests that China's rise will inevitably bring it into conflict with other countries, for example, with the United States. However, China is seeking to build a new alternative relationship. As a student of international relations, I'm all familiar with the so-called great power strategy. That is, the rise and fall of great powers may lead to conflict. And so the essentiality of this initiative is to avoid what we call suicide's trap, particularly between the status quo power like Washington and the rising power like Beijing. It's not because we are naive, but because we see there's no option. We must answer the history. The conceptualization of this new power, new type of power relationship demonstrates a hallmark, a significant change in the paradigm of the current international relations. It is more relevant since the pervasive misjudgment of China's intention in Asia and beyond. For example, if Washington's spectacular pivot to Asia hypothesis that Beijing will opt for an antagonistic posture, that can be wrong, because it miscalculates Beijing's intentions, since the core and the utmost subtlety of Beijing's strategy is precisely to remain non-confrontational. Although the territorial disputes with some neighbors, with China's neighbors, have flared up in the recent months, and there are also some disagreements over the ownership of maritime rights, but sometimes those concerns are overblown. China share, as a matter of fact, a special relationship with its neighbors. It's driven by shared values and the broadest conception of national interest. That is to say, we have a great stake in each other's success. In this regard, China will continue to consolidate a friendly relationship with its neighbors, and also to ensure that China's prosperity, China's development can benefit to them, and make greater efforts to find the convergence of interest. Of course, in the same time, as a developing country, China will do whatever it can to boost its ties and strengthen its solidarity and cooperation with other emerging countries and developing economies. China's growth and prosperity is framed as a positive energy in East Asia and the rest of the world. For example, after the meltdown in 2008, China now already become one of the biggest engines to putting the world economy back on the right track for the past few years. And while an unstable, an alternative scenario is an unstable or a weak China may be very dangerous. So it provides China these kind of conceptions, scenarios, choice, provides the fundamental rationale for China's grand strategy, that is peaceful development. This doctrine, however, underlies a striking contrast between a polarizing Chinese outlook. There is a debate, I have to say, inside China about this peaceful development. One view argue that China should play a more vigorous international part or international role, but the other, they argue that China should very much focus on its domestic agenda. So they both arguments carry on good reasons. They have good reason. Yet, I may subscribe subscribe that China cannot solve its own problems without greater international engagement. So I may belong to the first group. I advocate that China should get more involved, should be reaching out to the rest of the world. History will not repeat itself precisely, but if China retreats, history may reach out to grab us back. In conclusion, China demonstrates so far a unique ability to navigate a world of paradoxes where multipolarities is concomitant with interdependence. Thanks in large part to its openness and innovation, China remains a better position to confront any kind of potential challenges ahead. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I would love to address them. Thank you.
Okay. Who, back over here, please.
Hi, my name is James Potts. I'm at the British Consulate General. I'd like to talk about China's foreign policy. China's overseas investments are ever increasing. Its national interests are constantly now overseas. And it's been criticized before, particularly in relation to the Arab Spring, for sticking to its policy of non-intervention in other countries' internal affairs. So my question is, do you think China will ever change this stance? And under what circumstances do you think China would ever consider engaging or intervening in another country's affairs?
Well, thank you very much for your wonderful question. And I think this is the topic sometime very privately we have the discussing about what kind of orientation China's foreign policy will advance accordingly. As a matter of fact, as I understand it, I don't see any kind of rapid change whatsoever adjustment for this non-intervention approach for China's foreign policy. This does not mean China is hands off all those action scenarios to get involved in other countries. As a matter of fact, as a P5 member, China always supports to be very positive for any kind of contingency or scenarios, proposals, and mandated by the United Nations. For example, East Timor was a good example. China was part of it, this effort. Why? Because it's just passed the resolution and the United Nations give a green light. So this is an option for China in the future. And of course, for example, there is a debate in serious issues, particularly when China vetoed altogether three times so far. Well, I try to follow the situation and also the debate. And two things can explain that. The first of all is about Libya case. I guess some people, even some Chinese people, they are doing the soul searching, they're doing the reflection. When China voted in the Libya case, the resolution, to establish the low-fly zone. But this low-fly zone, very unfortunately, being used or misused as a green light to launch attack on Libya. This is absolutely against the Chinese intention and also our principles. So Chinese argue that we're not going to do it again. Secondly, about, for example, the R2P issue, the responsibility to protect. I guess China has increasingly come to understand protection is absolutely important, but with conditionalities. You can lay out the conditions. Even the R2P has their conditions, worked out their conditions. But instead, China argued that we should do responsible protection. Why? Because in the past, we have witnessed a couple of disasters happened when people just jumped into the intervention and then left out to walk away with the chaotic and the humanitarian disasters. For example, the Libya case is a good example. Some people cite it as a first case, successful case of RTP. But the critic, like I myself, I say, well, look at what is today in Libya. So many people that have guns illegally have guns, and also the terrorist group. And so where is this nation? The nation building, nobody take really care about this nation building. They just left. Their only mission is overthrow the regime there on the left. So we need to advocate a more responsible way to do the intervention to the protection.
Okay, Francis.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. 2 points, Doctor. One, the question of Syria. It's difficult to see what principle China is standing on in this case, because Assad surely at some point will go. And it doesn't appear there would be too many people who would thank the Chinese or the Russians for, in effect, assisting him to hang on overly long. So what is the principle that's at work for you there? And the second question I have is, you warned that history would not repeat itself exactly, but there were forces that could pull China back. And I just wonder what caution you're implying there. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your question. The first of all, about Syria issues. Unlike Russia, Russia has a huge economic strategic stake in Syria. For example, it has a military port there, and China has none. China, even the trade relationship between China and Syria is pretty tidy. I was fortunate, I was traveling to Syria last year. In May, I was invited to visit Syria to see and talk to those people. And my understanding, I think, I'm not trying to defend the Chinese veto on the Syria issue, but from what I knew when talking to those people, and also my research tells me that, you know, we should recalibrate our intervention. If your intervention just to overthrow a government, a regime, I think this will be some difficult for Chinese to digest those. Simply you don't like it. Or people say, well, there's a lot of killings over there, so it's a better way to protect the innocent people. Yes, this argument sounds reasonable, but the point is that the Assad, for the Bashar government, they have every responsibility to do that. And currently, what is happening on the ground in Syria? I see more and more so foreign smuggling weapons getting to those people there. And so the civil war, a kind of civil war, is blowing out. This is very unfortunate. That because the greater fighting, more severe fighting, means less desirability for the opposition, for other people to talk. China, we are not in favor of Bashar Assad, not at all. We are not a fan of him. But the point is, we have to defend our principle. Our principle, that is to say, we got to be very lucky if we need to jump to any kind of intervention scenario. Always, always. The second, you're right, and I put it in the presentation, that a strength may pull China back. When I see this, I basically refers to our bitter experience when China was under the self-imposed isolation era. That was miserable. That was very unfortunate. It has never done China any good. China's development is just because we choose the alternative. So Deng Xiaoping said, we got to open the door, to open to all over the world. So in the last 30 years is the most dramatic year for China's economy, for Chinese people. And so I don't see any kind of reason for China to retreat. But mind you, there are a few people that argue that we should very much only focus on the domestic agenda in China, because they certainly argue that China does not have that kind of resources or tools
to reaching out. But the point is, today's world, you can really hardly distinguish what is a domestic agenda and a foreign agenda. Very often, there are the two sides of one coin. So in order to do the better job domestically, I guess my feel is that China, we should do more to reach out. And also, as I said, China is a P5. China is also a very important player in the institution here in East Asia and Pacific. So that also generates people for desirability or anticipation for China to shoulder more responsibility. I guess that is the future. There's no way for us to go back.
Professor Westad of London School of Economics, in his book last year, Restless Empire, suggested that China's foreign policy, and particularly frontiers self-image, was formed by the borders of the Qing Empire, and that as a result, there's an inevitable sense of China in wanting to restore the preeminence it had in Asia then, and an inevitable worry on the part of all of China's neighbors that that will happen again. To what extent is China increasing those worries now by citing, for example, the nine-dot line from the Qing Empire and other historical documents that relate back to a period of clear Chinese preeminence and even dominance in Asian foreign policy?
Well, it's a great question. It's a great question. And let me put it this way. And we are, as I said, we already kicked off the modernization. As some people say, it's a rejuvenization of Chinese culture, Chinese civilization, or a renaissance, whatever you put it. That suggests Chinese, as we are, have a greater, increasingly greater, strong desirability to perform better on the world stage. There's no problem about it. But how about those border issues? The immediate challenge for China is how do you deal with those border issues and the disputes? Because the way you're dealing with the border disputes very often frame people's perception about China, whether you're assertive or weak, whatever. Let me put it this way. China, unlike Americans was very lucky. You got only two neighbors. Canada and Mexico, and then the two oceans. But for China, we border directly with 14 countries. You can never find any kind of other countries who border so many directly, the land border, 14 of them. And the point is, as I said, as people very often say, it's easy to love the whole human being. It's difficult to love your neighbor. And being neighbor is good, but the point is you have to build a good fence. Good fence means good neighbor. Let me back to the border dispute issues. We have successfully demarcated or solved the border problems, the land border problems, with one exception with India, with most of the countries, including Russia. You know, in the 1960s, China and Russia engaged bloody conflict just because of the small islands there. And China borders 4,300 kilometers common border with Russia. Russia is our largest neighbor. But we have successfully demarcated all the remaining disputes. And we have done this with many other neighbors. Of course, with the difficult parts with India. So that means We can resolve the issues by negotiation, by talk, by diplomatic efforts. Today, of course, there is because of the Diaoyu Islands and the Huangya Islands, other issues came out. With respect to this, I sometimes feel that it's a kind of unfair to accuse China to initiate or to trigger all this clash or disputes. As a matter of fact, no matter Huangya Islands or the Diaoyu Islands, China was just returning the ball. China is not the border. So we have to do whatever we can to defend and to safeguard the legitimate interest and the sovereignty. But some people say, well, China, you become overreactive or more assertive. But if you talk to the Japanese, for example, today there's a very important delegation from Tokyo to Beijing. They're holding maybe a kind of talk. I don't know. I hope the pressure will take off. But for China, we're absolutely committed to peaceful resolution, peaceful dialogue. There's no way for China to use military. There's no way for China to use what alternative forces and rules. That's not just the option. For us, like as I said, the daunting task for China is domestic in the for the future leadership. We have numerous problems in China. How to address, for example, the disparities issues, haves and have-nots, and how to address the corruption issues, and how to address the environmental issues. And I was coming here yesterday. I was so impressed by the beautiful weather here. But in Beijing, you know, we just suffered to the worst haze or polluted week. We desire to have a better fresh air. So we got very much committed in addressing those issues. I don't think Chinese policymakers and the serious commentators that have any appetite to launch a military strike. But what's for? So, again, to conclude, what I'd like to mean is that we have all these disputes, but we're committed to talk. So this is the point.
Okay. Okay.
I think I'd like to hear, could you please elaborate on what you talked about before, China trying to build an alternative power relationship to those in the past? Because I think what is confusing to China watchers is that China, since Deng Xiaoping, has focused on its peaceful rise, its economic rise. And it is only now in recent years that outsiders see China building the first Blue Water Navy in 500 years, and becoming more assertive in a big swath of territory along the nine dot line map and some other areas. So could you elaborate in your thinking?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, yes, indeed. I spent quite a long time in discussing the major power, new type of major power relationship. And I guess a couple of points here is very important. And we cannot just afford to engage a kind of confrontational approach or relations with other powers, particularly with the United States of America. And the history tells us that the rising power and the status quo power very often get involved, get engaged in a very unpleasant way. I don't think China will have that appetite whatsoever. But we have to think very hard, what is the alternative? So far, I guess, we are very clear what we don't want. We don't want a zero-sum game. We don't want a zero-sum major power relationship. And of course, we don't want to say China's rise is the demise of the United States. So I very much appreciate VP Vice President Joe Biden. He did it long ago on the New York Times. After his tour to China. So the title I can remember is China's Rise is Not the Demise of the United States. So these are the very, very significant, very, very nuanced mindset. So we are trying to grasp. Of course, it takes two to tango. For China, we alone, we cannot accomplish this mission. We have to work with others, particularly with our friends in Washington. And here, let me dig a little bit. So since I worked in Washington for a few years, this relationship has been so strongly tied with each other. I very often tell my friends in China, let's say, wow, United States is supporting Japan in the Diaoyu Island dispute, so they would like to check China and contain China. Lots of conspiracy theories going on. But I asked them a very few questions. So do you know how much institution, governmental sponsored institution China and the United States has? Nobody can give me a great answer. The updates, the newest status is about more than 90 government institution and a dialogue between Washington and Beijing. Well, people say, well, yes, you can have so many dialogue about why the relationship, the mistrust is still go further. My argument is pretty simple. What about if we don't have this dialogue and its institutions? What kind of scenarios do you anticipate? It will be even better, or it will be even worse, sorry. So I cannot, I'm not naive to say since we have such a good relationship and so many strong dynamic dialogue and institutions exchange will address the mistrust issue. But the point I like to do is that we will cultivate the habit on both sides for dialogue to address the problem. And we already talked to our friends and counterparts in Washington. They are pretty interested in this notion. So maybe in the future, we can do think tanks on both sides. We can do the joint research project with each other. And of course, having said this, I don't mean we just like to explore this new type of relationship with the United States. As a matter of fact, China is open to others. We want to build a new type of relationship with Russia, for example. In the Russia, we were allies in the 50s, right? But that was a pretty bitter experience for China. We are now have to build a new type of relationship based on mutual trust and mutual benefits and a cooperative. And with regard to the peaceful rise and also the growing military buildup, I think, first of all, it's pretty natural for China. We need, definitely need, I'm not hiding, say we don't need a bigger military army. No, not at all, that's not true. If I say that, I'm not honest. I say, what I'll tell you there is that we got to have a much stronger and more capable military as China is becoming more and more prosperous. As you are rightly to mention the point, China's interest has been spread all over the world in the past few decades. Chinese corporation, Chinese people everywhere in the corner under the sun. So, but the point, the challenge for China is how to defend our legitimate interest, the economic interest, the personnel's safety interest, the national interest, and whatsoever. So it definitely needs more resources in match that kind of widely enlarged spreading of your interest border. But this does not mean that China will engage in a military conflict with any other. And I just talked to a case about, for example, America will get a kind of energy independence in a couple of years. And so the question, my American friends approached me with the question, if I got energy independence from Middle East, but look at you guys, you're increasingly relying on your energy on Middle East, so what are you going to do? I no longer protect you. And well, this puts China in a very awkward position. On one hand, we need a stronger, for example, military means to protect the sea link, to fight the pirates, for example, and for that kind of purpose. But in the same time, when China engages in whatever the military buildup, it will surely invite a lot of backlash or critic. They will ask, what's your attention? Or they will view China as this is a kind of assertive behavior. But I ask my American friends, yes, maybe you are going back, but the point, do you mean that to encourage or you like to see China have a bigger levy? He said, no, That's not what I mean. So the best way maybe is we can talk to our American friends. You are a shooter, you are doing the protection part, and maybe China can contribute marginally to some of those missions, like anti-piracy, which happens in the coastal area, in the Somalia area. And of course, we will work together to address the disputes in the Middle East, for example. That is a very thorny area and a huge, difficult one. So yes, indeed, we are developing greater military, but this does not mean we're trying to become a purely a military figure and we will use it. But how to use it, that is very, very difficult to say.
Okay, I think we're just about at 2 o'clock, unless we have one more. Why don't I wrap it up by thanking very much our speaker, as well as the Foreign Ministry, for bringing Dr. Ruan to us today. I'd like to also give you something to remember the club by.
Oh. Guess from the shape.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming. We hope to see you.